On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
Here is the full, not very long statement inside the last 15 minutes from the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen.
I had a constructive and useful phone call with Prime Minister Boris Johnson. We discussed the major unsolved topics. Our negotiation teams have been working day and night over the recent days. And despite the exhaustion after almost 1 year of negotiations, and despite the fact that deadlines have been missed over and over, we both think that it is responsible at this point in time to go the extra mile. We have accordingly mandated our negotiators to continue the talks and to see whether an agreement can be reached, even at this late stage. The negotiations continue here in Brussels. Thank you so much.
So that is the entirety of what Ursula von der Leyen had to say to reporters in Brussels about 20 minutes ago. Let's speak to George Parker, the political editor of the Financial Times. He joins us from London. George, you've shown much more flexibility than the British government has this morning in rearranging your phone call. So thanks very much for agreeing speak to us a little bit later than originally planned. I don't know what to make of what we've just heard, whether it's a case that there is progress and they don't want to allow a deadline get in the way of progress, or whether they are talking simply because the consequences of giving up are too grave.
I think it's probably a mixture of both. I mean, I've always been on the end of the spectrum, which thinks that at the end of the deal, at the end of this process, there will be a deal because both sides badly need a deal. And although people say that the differences between them are huge, actually, I'm not entirely sure they're as big as all that. And I suspect if there is a deal in a few weeks' time, we'll have forgotten what all the arguments were about. But, you know, big differences obviously do remain. However, the readout that we've just had from Boris Johnson and Ursula von der Leyen, the fact that they've described these talks as useful and constructive suggests to me, and indeed we're picking up behind the scenes as well, that there has been at least no sign of the talks going backwards, which is progress of its own, I suppose.
So are you hearing then anything different from Ursula von der Leyen inside the London bubble, or is the readout still a similar anodyne, we'll talk because we have to talk?
To be honest, because we only just had this, I'm about to start making the calls to the people working behind the scenes on this. But what we do have is on the record comments from Dominic Raab, the Foreign Secretary, this morning, which I think gave you an indication that the talks have gone reasonably well over the last few days. He said that if the EU was prepared to move, there was a high level of confidence we could get a deal. And he narrowed down the sort of areas of difference to two sort of main points: fisheries and, of course, the sort of this level playing field idea that as the EU rules evolve, if the UK doesn't evolve its rules at the same speed, what happens then? And he was saying, well, we can't have the EU launching a nuclear strike, or separately said, a torpedo against us. But I would have thought there's some grey area in there. You stick in a sort of intermediate body to arbitrate and all that sort of stuff. I think there's still room for a solution on this. And actually, one thing I'll just point out that Dominic Raab did say, he's a lawyer, by the way. He said, there's always creative contours in the drafting, which is diplomatic speak for a gallon of fudge that you can pour over any sort of agreement. And of course, that's how agreements in international treaties get over the line. So I would say, if you were sort of gauging the optimism-ometer, I would say it's edged up a notch this morning, certainly.
And there was me thinking that creative contours were something that you saw makeup artists give you their tutorials on Instagram, but maybe that's just the crowd that I hang around with. You seem very optimistic that there could actually be a deal done, particularly when it comes to level playing field. And I don't know whether I share that optimism, and maybe you might tell me where you do, because I just don't know whether the EU can, having, you know, climbed up to the top of the mountain as it has, whether it can allow another country on its doorstep with which it shares a land border to have full access to its single market without abiding by all the same restrictions on state aid and undercutting of the markets. And I don't know where there's flexibility there.
Okay. Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, it does seem an ideological, it's the most ideological issue. The fisheries issue is basically just a haggle about numbers and years, and they can sort that out. But as you say, this is an ideological divide between the two sides, and it is difficult. And that's why it's the big remaining sticking point. I think the thing is that the UK has already conceded a certain amount, hasn't it? It's already agreed that we aren't going to go backwards from where we are at the moment. So that's one. So we've conceded, the UK has conceded the principle that we can't expect to enjoy access to the European market unless we abide by at least existing EU rules. So then the question is, well, what happens if the EU moves forward? Well, you know, if this was a reciprocal arrangement where, let's say, the UK moves faster than the EU, which I think is entirely possible, mm-hmm. would the UK then be able to say, well, in that case, we want to impose tariffs on the EU? I think between the two sides, there needs to be some kind of arbitration mechanism or panel to arbitrate on disputes. First of all, to make sure that any deviation is actually significant, and B, to make sure that any retaliatory tariffs are proportional. And I think that's important for both sides, because if it's going to be a reciprocal arrangement, which presumably it would have to be, the EU would want some sort of reassurances on that point as well. The only other thing I would say is that, you know, I know that there's a breakdown of trust, which is why all this is having to be nailed down. In the past, I think before the UK unilaterally decided it was prepared to rip up last year's withdrawal agreement, I think this is something which could have been agreed between two sides in a slightly more trusting atmosphere, you know, with letters of assurance and panels in the future. But it's because the trust has broken down that it's made things a lot more easier, much more difficult to actually to finalise. But I still think the lawyers can get to work there and find a space to operate. Mm.
We've discussed when we've talked about this a few times past about how fundamentally odd it is that a Conservative government, which by its nature is a free market government, and the EU is a largely free market idea as well, single digital market and everything else, how weird it is that the UK could potentially mark itself up to the top of the hill and then back down again over the right to underpin and provide state aid for companies, when that's kind of anathema to what Conservatives do. And when we talked about that before, you said, well, it's Dominic Cummings because he wants to make sure that the next Google is British and that he can underwrite the whole thing. And I sort of wonder whether his agenda is still driving the whole thing, even if he himself isn't around anymore.
Well, I think he was certainly the one who was driving the state aid issue. And actually, funny enough, state aid seems to become less of an issue as the talks have dragged on, which seems to coincide with Dominic Cummings' departure from number 10. But there is still the sort of broader question, isn't there, about this level playing field and the standards that are applied across the board, whether it's environment or workers' rights or indeed state aid. I mean, in a way, I've often thought about this. It's a strange thing. I can understand why the Europeans are distrustful of a Conservative government, because after all, the thing that ideologically was driving Brexit for a long time was Thatcherite ideology, the idea that the EU was thwarting the completion of the Thatcher revolution of deregulating everything. But more recently, the Conservative Party has realised there's no appetite for that in the country at all anyway. And secondly, since they've started to make inroads into former Labour seats in the north of England, what those voters want is better protection at work, and certainly not deregulation, you know. So,
George, I'm sorry to interrupt you and just to rush you along, because we're a little short on time. Yeah. One brief question. Would there be any parliamentary hurdles to getting this ratified if there was to finally be a deal, irrespective of whatever concessions Britain has to make to get it over the line? Is there any danger of the House of Commons shooting it down?
No danger at all. The Labour Party is broadly going to support whatever deal comes back from Brussels. Boris Johnson's got an 80-seat majority. So whatever comes back will be rushed through Parliament at breakneck speed, certainly before the end of the year.
Well, rush through one Parliament at least. We'll see what MEPs have to say about it. In the meantime, George, very much appreciate your flexibility this morning, and thanks very much for coming on to us before you've had a chance to call around your sources in SW1. Very much appreciated. George Parker, political editor of the Financial Times, and by the way, former chief of the Brussels Bureau. So speaking to us there in just a few minutes.